The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic, tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily access newsletter to keep on top of all the latest news from China from hundreds of different news sources, or check out all the original writing, including reported stories, editorials, and regular columns, as well as our growing library of videos and, of course, podcasts on our website. We cover everything from China's fraught foreign relations to its ingenious entrepreneurs, from the ongoing repression of Uyghurs and other Muslim people in China's Xinjiang region to China's ambitious efforts to eliminate poverty. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Joining me from his sprawling 40-acre estate just outside Nashville, Tennessee, is Jeremy Goldkorn, the man recently outed as the individual who runs Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn's Twitter account, and who was responsible for her December 3rd tweet that read, "China has a 5,000-year history of cheating and stealing. Some things will never change." Classic Jeremy. May you continue to provide nuanced and balanced insights from our esteemed senator.
Our esteemed Senator Marsha, she's great, isn't she? God, yeah. Only the best for us here in Tennessee.
You know,
anyway,
besides enjoying just such brilliant legislators, our great thing about being an American, a citizen of this hegemonic imperium, is the way that we dominate the global discourse, not only through the power of our media or our unalloyed narcissism, but also because of the massively consequential nature of what we as a polity just decide to do. It must be maddening to the rest of the world, and it is absurdly unfair, of course, and we apologize here for dedicating a show to how a particular segment of the Chinese intelligentsia is taking in and talking about American politics, but I think this is nevertheless a very significant topic.
Significant and very interesting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
At some point, it's become particularly interesting in recent weeks. At some point, right around the time of the election, China Twitter, you know, the people on Twitter who talk about China a lot, was abuzz with the sickening realization that there were a lot of Chinese intellectuals, including many prominent dissidents, who were enthusiastic, avid, and maybe even rabid supporters of Donald Trump. Many people among those of us in the United States who study China, hawks or doves, they're still mostly Democrats. These people were disappointed, but not altogether surprised to see the blind self-taught lawyer Chen Guangcheng speaking at the Republican National Convention. But it went way beyond that, with figures from Wang Dan of 1989 fame to Tsinghua sociologist Guo Yuhua to the artist Ai Weiwei, all outing themselves on Twitter, especially in the aftermath of the election, as Trumpsters of one stripe or another, amplifying Trump's post-election lies about supposed election fraud.
We've talked a lot on this show and in various essays on SubChina about the whole phenomenon of Trump support in China and among Chinese Americans in the U.S., but what we're talking about here specifically
is what many would call liberal intellectuals in China, including some outright opponents of the Chinese Communist Party. So we've asked our two guests today to help us make sense of this. Lin Yao, or Yao Lin if you prefer the English name order, received his doctorate in political science from Columbia University, but is now at Yale Law School finishing his JD. And for my money, he's just been one of the smartest people writing on this particular phenomenon. Much of our discussion today will focus on a paper he published in the Journal of Contemporary China in May of this year. The paper is called Beaconism and the Trumpian Metamorphosis of Chinese Liberal Intellectuals. And it's just one of the best things I've read this year. It's a super smart, superbly argued piece that isn't actually bogged down at all in methodology. And it offers a kind of grand tour of the Chinese political and intellectual landscape, including some corners of it that I personally find revolting and fascinating in equal measure. Lin Yao, welcome to Seneca.
Thank you, Kaiser. Thank you, Jeremy. You can just call me Yao.
Okay, I'll call you Yao.
It makes it easy. Okay, our second guest is our old friend Ian Johnson, who joins us from his new redoubt in Singapore, now that he is a persona non grata in the People's Republic. Ian writes for the New York Times, but also publishes frequently in the New York Review of Books and the New Yorker, and has written recently for one more New York-based publication, our own SubChina. He is the author, most recently, of The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, a book that we discussed with him on our program. Ian wrote an opinion piece about today's topic for The Times titled Why Do Chinese Liberals Embrace American Conservatives?, which cites Lin Yao's work. And we're very happy that he could also join us to talk about that. Ian, welcome back to Seneca.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be on the show.
All right. So, guys, Huang Yasheng at MIT, who's somebody, as you know, he's been in the trenches for the last 4+ years doing battle with Chinese Trump supporters. He had an extremely pithy response to the question in the published headline of Ian, your op-ed, which, to remind you, asked, why do Chinese liberals embrace American conservatives? And Huang Yasheng's answer on Twitter was simply, because they're not liberals. And isn't he right? I mean, can we really call them liberals? I mean, Teng Biao, he is a liberal, right? Teng Biao, he's definitely, you know, a liberal as we all would understand it. But my point is that we should probably define our terms first. So what is liberalism, ziyopai, in the contemporary Chinese political context?
And I think we should particularly do that, if I may just add a note from the colonies or from outside America, at least, is that the word liberal is used in America to mean pretty much anyone from Joe Biden to Trotsky, whereas it has a much more limited meaning in most other parts of the world. So, yes, let's define our terms.
Yeah, well, I think that was a very catchy headline. And it was, you know, done, of course, by somebody else, as always happens at newspapers. But when we think of, I think the word liberal in the headline was being used the way Americans think of dissidents, in quotation marks, that dissidents are for freedom and they are against authoritarianism and therefore they must have a sort of liberal streak. And then especially coming from a more left-oriented newspaper, slightly left of center, let's say, like the New York Times, liberals are sort of the good guys also. So it sort of seems that's how I think these people are portrayed. But simply being against the CCP doesn't mean that you are a liberal. You can be against the government for a number of reasons. And some of them is love of freedom, let's say, and less government interference, which would be classic liberalism. But then there's also a bunch of other reasons. And I think one of the things that unites a lot of these people is contrarianism, and that a lot of them are sort of skeptical of the received wisdom. And so this makes them sort of almost paradoxically, they want to support the person who's sort of the most troublesome in some ways. And because everybody in this sort of the well-meaning, educated left in the West are anti-Trump, you know, you have to be sort of anti-Trump. That makes a lot of the people think, oh, maybe there is something to this guy Trump. You know, maybe we should sort of see his side of it. And I think also that when people see the establishment come down hard on one side, that they want to take the other side. They always think there's another side to it. And I think this is the experience in China. You know, the establishment mainstream media will be in one way, and then you automatically think there has to be a counter story to this. There has to be a conspiracy or something behind it that we just don't quite know. And so I think they're more receptive to those ideas without necessarily
one of these motivations
has to do with liberalism, really.
They thought about headlines like, why are the good guys supporting the bad guys? Or why are the Chinese contrarians embracing this contrarian guy? wasn't going to work. Li Yao, what about you, Yao?
The question of like what liberalism really means, of course, is a really difficult question. People have been debating about it. And for me, I think we need to go to the context. I mean, in the US, liberal is used in a quite narrow way. It isn't even used in the same way as many European countries, right? In Spain or France, liberal has a more right-leaning connotation than in the US. And in China, I think 自由派, basically, we can define it a bit more broadly, but not as broad as to the point of meaningless. I think 自由派 or liberals in China basically have several fundamental tenets or fundamental beliefs, believe in constitutional protection of basic rights, believe in competitive multi-party electoral systems. I think those are the two tenets of Chinese liberalism and liberalism in general, I would say. And then there are some particular features of Chinese liberalism, for example, a kind of aversion to Maoist planned economy. They will advocate marketization to some point, but not necessarily complete deregulation of the market. I think some Chinese liberals would say that we need quite a bit of regulation of the market, but just not don't go back to the Maoist era where we have a planned economy or even command economy, right? And also Chinese liberalism is to some extent opposite to a kind of narrow-minded or military nationalism. So usually if you go to the Chinese internet, you will see a debate frequently between Chinese liberal intellectuals on the one hand and those more nationalist-minded intellectuals who assert that China, it's time for China to rise, China must export the China model to the world, China must compete with Western powers in the international arena. And Chinese liberals frequently say that this is not the case. We need a peaceful coexistence with other countries. We don't want to dominate them. So I think the idea of constitutional rights, the idea of competitive elections, the idea of this peaceful, non-militarist, non-nationalist coexistence with the world, aversion against the Maoist style planned economy or command economy are defining features of Chinese liberalism.
That makes them sound very reasonable.
Yeah, I was going to say that's very acceptable to your labradoodle owning, liberal in Berkeley or Chapel Hill.
He's a golden doodle.
Okay. A golden doodle. Oh, I'm sorry. a golden doodle. That's one step up in the kind of Bobo stakes, I guess. So what are some of the more egregious examples of Chinese intellectuals avidly favoring Donald Trump now? And who are some of the more prominent critics of the Chinese Communist Party who have come out strongly in favor of Trump? And a question for either of you, Yao or Ian.
Okay, I can start. For example, Guo Yuhua, a female sociology professor at Tsinghua University, who I admire very much, have been pro-Trump for many years, since 2015 or 2016, when Trump first announced his campaign. And to this day, right? So she has been a fervent critic of the CCP for many years, and she isn't someone you would characterize as neoliberal or conservative in the usual sense of the term, because she has been advocating for workers' rights, she has been advocating for independent worker unions, she had been advocating for greater transfer of wealth to the lower class for many years, right? So she criticized the regime, and she also criticized some of the impacts of capitalism, of unregulated market. And also Xiao Han, a Chinese legal scholar at the Zhengfa Dashi, who recently came out as pro-Trump, and saying that, oh, I've been studying all the news from the West, and now the turning point for me is the Hunter Biden, you know, hard drive gate, and I just realized that the mainstream media in the U.S. are completely covering up the thing, and Trump is the lone fighter against all the untruths, against the immorality in the world, and I hope he wins and something like that. So those are the two examples that come to my mind.
Yeah, Guo Yuhua is even like a really like a staunch supporter of Xu Zhongrun, so it's very surprising to see her.
I've known her pretty well, and I did a Q&A with her for the New York Review of Books, and I was also surprised. I mean, I think in her case, there's a little bit of my enemy's enemy is my friend, and I think that in that case, they you know, she and people like her probably think that at last the U.S. is kind of waking up, and that anything that can be done to sort of deal the CCP a body blow is good. And so for her, I kind of understand it a little bit more. But I still don't see why you would support somebody who is so also fundamentally anti-democratic like Trump is. That's, I think, the paradox, that you could support some of his policies toward China without supporting him stock and barrel. That's the thing that's sort of the most troubling, if you will, or perplexing, is just this need to go in whole hog in supporting somebody.
Right. Let me ask you guys what may strike you as a rather blunt question, which is, why does it actually matter that liberal Chinese intellectuals are disproportionately favoring Donald Trump? Why does that matter at all?
Well, it matters in the U.S. Electoral College, of course, because we know China is going to get Electoral College votes. So this is important. No, I mean, I don't know exactly. No, you could say I don't know. No, I think it says something about intellectual discourse in China. I mean, it says something about the poverty of debate to some degree, and the. Of course, you have a lot of people in the United States who supported Trump. You had 70 million or whatever people who voted for him, and many smart people also voted for Trump.
Name me one.
It's almost like I'm just trying to be nice. But I do think that there's maybe also a level of desperation in this to some degree. Like when I see Guo Yuhuan, people like that supporting Trump, I just don't, it's very, very hard to sort of understand it except almost as a form of desperation, that with everything sort of collapsing, there's really no outlet to publish anything, and they're under such pressure that maybe in some way this person seems like a good one. But I think there's other things at work also, like I was saying before, this love of conspiracy theories and also just a perverse contrarianism, which I think in some ways is healthy, but it's also destructive.
Right.
I think it matters. It matters at least in two ways. First, for China and for the U.S. So even though the effects might be long term, so you can't really discern them right now. But I think for China, so intellectuals are important agencies for public discourses, right? They invent the terms, the concept, the vocabulary, the defined agenda of discussion. They legitimate certain concepts, certain ideas, right? And they steer the direction of the prevalent social and political thoughts. So in China, when Chinese liberal intellectuals start to support someone who is such a blatant failure, it quickly delegitimizes liberalism in Chinese context. So now a lot of ordinary Chinese citizens, especially in this in this year, in light of the completely meltdown of the U.S. response to the pandemic, they have been mocking Chinese liberalism, Chinese liberal intellectuals, for being so blinded to the reality of the world, right? So, and in the future, suppose the younger generation grows up in 20 years, in 30 years, and it is time for some incoming political transformation in China, and now liberals at that time want to persuade Chinese citizens to follow their suit, and saying that, oh, the democracy is a good thing. We want to have liberalism, constitutional protection of rights is a good thing. So they will say that you guys have been supporting someone like Trump, and you have been supporting Trump's destroyings of U.S. democratic system. So why should we trust you?
Right.
A pretty good question.
Even for those who follow Trump, like who still believe in those Chinese intellectuals, we must wonder what path they will go down. Like maybe in 20 years time, it will come down to a duel between the CCP on the one hand and those who, those degenerated, I don't know, like distorted liberalism on the other hand. And that's, of course, a really bad thing for China and for the world, where China is
not much of a choice, right?
Yes. And for the US, I think it is also important. And part of the effect we have seen this year with the Epoch Times and Apple Dailies and spreading fake news, spreading misinformation. And how did that begin? I think part of how it began can be found in the larger transformation in the Chinese public discourse, in which Chinese liberals play a big role because they have been legitimizing Trump during the past few years, and they have been encouraging the spread of misinformation and so on and forth. So when journalists or semi-journalists, right, those who work in zimeiti, I don't know how to translate that term, but like those who play a journalist roles, right, and they become willingly accept and internalize those rhetorics and misinformation. And when they join force in reporting the U.S. elections this year, and maybe being recruited by Guo Wengui or by Da Jiyuan, the effect shows, right? And it goes to the point of even influencing the U.S. politics, influencing the U.S. election, right? So I think the butterfly effect of the transformation of Chinese liberal intellectuals is really huge. It's just that we haven't been able to see it in full play at this moment. But right. In a few years down the road, we will see how disastrous it will be.
I completely agree.
So let's look at the starting point of all of this. You've hinted at some of them, both of you already. But can we talk about the different explanations that you've heard put forward and why you find them to be unsatisfactory? And let's start with this, Yao. What is insufficient about the simple enemy of my enemy explanation? These guys hate the party. Trump and his administration made it their main foreign policy objective to poke Beijing in the eye with a stick. And so naturally they love Trump. And I should just say that, I mean, this explanation in some ways makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I think the appeal of Trump for many people who otherwise would not find anything appealing in him is that he sometimes says what people are thinking and not willing to say. And for a lot of Americans, even ones who study China and, this group of Chinese people, it can be very pleasant to hear somebody say the Communist Party is, you know, the devil incarnate, whereas previous American administrations would mince their words.
Yeah, so as you said, I think this explanation is quite intuitive and appealing, and a lot of people endorse it. To some extent, Ian, I think you did, right? It was one of the hypotheses that I rejected in my paper. So I don't think this tactical explanation is satisfactory. Why? Because when you look into the early transformations, early endorsements by Chinese liberal intellectuals since 2015, 2016, you realize that they were not talking about Trump's attitude towards China, Trump's trade war, which hasn't happened yet at the time. What were they talking about? They were talking about political correctness. They were talking about, oh, the American racial protest have gone too far. Black Lives Matter is a disaster. And political correctness is suffocating American society. And here comes Trump. He's a anti-political correctness guy. He's an anti-Black Lives Matter guy. He's a, you know, he will revive American society. So, Sun Liping, another sociology professor at Tsinghua University, wrote an article comparing Trump with Deng Xiaoping in late 2017 or early 2018. So he says that there were two greatest political experiments in human history so far. One is reform and opening by Deng Xiaoping, which saved and revived China. And the other is the Trump's political correctness war, which would save and revive the U.S. So those are the two greatest human beings in human history. That's what he said.
We'll get into political correctness in a bit here. But so basically, you're saying you reject the tactical argument because, for the obvious reason that prior to China becoming an issue really at all, they were already on board with Trump, and it was because of this issue of political correctness. There's another explanation that you've heard a lot, and one that you devote another good part of your paper to refuting, and that's the neoliberal affinity argument. I mean, again, that's one where when you were talking about sort of what defines liberalism in China, you would flick at the idea that they are pro-market reform generally. As you say, it's really more they don't want Maoist, central planning excess. But this really important paper that was done by Yiqing Xu and Jennifer Pan looked at the way that these ideas cluster, how it seems that in China and, often in other countries as well, you have a clustering of sort of political democratic values and economic sort of pro-market values, classic sort of neoliberalism, right? Why is that not a satisfactory explanation for this pro-Trump phenomenon that we're seeing?
Yeah, sure. So Yiqing and Jennifer, Yiqing is my friend, and I like their work very much. But
it's a great paper.
I have to disagree to some extent with their conclusion. Not that their conclusions are wrong, but simply I think they rely on some questionnaire which were designed by random netizens, including myself. I was involved a couple years ago with, we discussed with friends on BBS, and we come up with that questionnaire, and we put it in use, testing ordinary citizens, which is another problem with applying their conclusion to analyzing Chinese liberal intellectuals, because that questionnaire was not designed for intellectuals who might have more sophisticated understanding of those issues, who might be able to decouple the different dimensions, right, better than ordinary citizens. And as to intellectuals, I think many people have been saying, oh, Chinese liberals are really neoliberals. I think that might be true to some extent. Many of them have this pro-market attitude out of their lived experience, but it doesn't... It cannot be overgeneralized. I mean, for example, Guo Yuhua and Sun Liping, they are not neoliberal as we would typically understand. Sun Liping wrote a lot of articles advocating a Northern European model, right? Saying that we need to look up to Sweden and Norway because they have better social welfare system than the US and so on and forth. And even for those ostensibly neoliberal intellectuals, even for those who have been saying out loud that we need as much privatization as possible, we need to understand how come they become neoliberals in the first place. So what is the process of socialization and internalization of those neoliberal ideologies for them? And so if that's something that needs to be explained, then it cannot be the independent explanation for their later Trumpian transformation. So maybe the Trumpian transformation and the neoliberal transformation are both the effect of the same cause, which then I argue is the kind of big political bigness sociology they have acquired and developed through their lived experience with Maoism and then later enforced with the rise of Xi Jinping.
Yeah, we'll get into beaconism in just one second.
Ian, let me put a question to you, because it seems that the neoliberal affinity argument might come from the sense that what we're seeing now with these Chinese Trump fans is a lot like what we saw in Poland and the Czech Republic, then still Czechoslovakia, back in the late 80s and following the end of the Cold War, when many of the liberals who enjoyed support in the United States turned out to hold some surprising beliefs that did not sit so well with the golden doodle owning liberals of Chapel Hill.
Golden
Berkeley.
Doodles were only bred for the first time in Australia in the early 1990s, and so they.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Let's not introduce anachronisms. Dog breed anachronisms into this.
So, as with, you know, the same, you saw a kind of similar thing with some of the Russian dissidents who enjoyed support in the US and other Western countries in the 70s and 80s. So, Ian, do you think this is part of it? And you were reporting from Berlin for quite a good stretch of that time period I've just mentioned. Does this strike you as, you know, similar to what you saw in Eastern Europe?
Well, to some degree, I think people have a hard time, like we all do, escaping our past and how we were trained to think about things, or how we were brought up to think about things. And I think that for many people in China, at least in the intellectuals, let's say, in the intellectual circles, you know, there's a lot of arguments are kind of ad hoc and not really tested out very well. You know, like, I know this is getting into some more very unprovable hypotheses, but it has a real effect on somebody if they've never read, let's say, a reliable or had reliable benchmark information on stuff. I think it's hard for people to even come up with coherent arguments. Like if you think of somebody like Guo Yihua, who is a terribly intelligent person and done some first-rate work, but sometimes the lack of facts that they have at their disposal, or reliable facts, because for them everything is up in the air. Everything is open for debate. There's almost like no real hard facts that they feel they can rely on. So it leads them down these weird blind alleys, I find.
It really sounds like you're describing American Trumpers.
Yes, I think so also. No, I see a huge similarity where people nowadays have not read newspapers, don't subscribe to newspapers. And in some ways, China is in advance of that, in that there was no reliable information. I mean, if you're in China, like, what's the reliable newspaper you're going to read? You know, if you're in the United States, you could say, well, I'll read the New York Times, I'll read the Wall Street Journal, I'll read a couple of other things to get different points of view. Of course, they all have their biases, but there's some like basic factual, you know, basis to them. In China, what are you going to read? Like Beijing Ribao or something like that? I mean, or what's the good newspaper? What's the decent newspaper where you're going to get basic facts and a reality check too? It's, everything's like a morass. It's like you're swimming in a sea of bullshit and truth and like all this stuff that you, it's really hard to, you know, you have your intuitive way of figuring things out, and you triangulate things against your lived experiences and what other people tell you and things like that. But it's, I think it's just hard to get real information, and that leads to these kind of weird intellectual gymnastics sometimes that people go through. But this is maybe getting down a slightly different path from what you want to talk about.
So y'all, your conclusion in your paper is that it's not tactical, it's not neoliberal affinity, it's actually this phenomenon, as you've mentioned, of beaconism that's most useful in understanding the Chuanhua, or the Trumpian metamorphosis. You talk about two types of beaconism, political and civilizational. What are these, and which do you see as the one that's primarily at work in this metamorphosis?
Good. So political Bitcoinism, I describe as a kind of a psychological mechanism that grows out of Chinese liberals' collective lived experience of Maoism, and that later the recollection, that the collective memory, collective recollection of Maoism. So because at the time of reform and opening, they have already suffered a lot from Cultural Revolution and so on and so forth. And they have they are opening up their eyes to a more prosperous Western world. So they internalize this kind of black and white contrast between China and West, the Chinese political regime and Western political regime. In order to strengthen their rhetoric advocating for liberal democracy in China, they kind of intentionally or unintentionally internalize a rhetorical strategy that sanitizes the actually existing democracies in the West, especially right. In the US, because for Chinese, US is the major contrast point. Other countries are either too small or too poor, so they think, oh, that China and US, that those are the two comparable great powers in the world. So Chinese liberal intellectuals, in advocating for the ideal of liberal democracy, they inadvertently sanitize the liberal democratic practice in the US. So what does it mean by sanitizing it? Sanitizing it means that, well, you can admit that there are some minor problems currently existing in the system. No system is perfect, right? But you cannot admit to any major systematic institutional failures on the US part. Right. So when US liberals, US leftists, self-criticize, and when US social movements demand that, the US confront its own problem of systematic racism, Chinese liberal intellectuals recoiled, and they think that that's a great self undermining, right? You undermine yourself because you admit that you have some systematic problem, and which can be taken advantage by the CCP, because CCP has been saying that the US has a lot of human rights abuse problems and racism problems and so on and so forth, right? So how can we now argue to the Chinese people that liberal democracy is great if the most powerful country, liberal democratic country in the world, still has systematic racism problem, right? And still have, and also those Chinese liberals, because of their lived experience with the Cultural Revolution, and they are especially keen to compare events in overseas with their own lived experience, and they, because that's the most readily available vocabulary for them, right? So right. When they see that, oh, Black Lives Matter the protests are tearing down Confederacy monuments, they think this is poor si jiu, this is destroying the four O's in the Cultural Revolution, right? And political correctness, that's of course 很多事情一闪念, right? So you criticize right. yourself and in front of the portrayal of Mao Zedong, which was also something some of them had experienced in the Cultural Revolution. So they reconceptualize and analyze everything that's going on in the US according to their own Cultural Revolution generated vocabulary, which, you know, of course, has the effect of distorting what's the understanding of the U.S. politics. And then with all this perceived self-criticism and self-owning by the American intellectuals, they feel a growing sense of frustration with their American counterparts, which is where the intuitive explanation of enemy's enemy comes in, because over the past decade, with the rise of Xi Jinping, Chinese liberal intellectuals have been feeling more and more suffocated, right? But by the tightening political atmosphere, and they have been hoping that the their counterparts in US, in Europe, might stand up and do something, just do something. But again and again, they see that their US counterparts are prioritizing self-criticism, prioritizing right. advocating domestic racial justice over the plight of Chinese people. So that's more and more frustrating for them. And because this predisposition of political liberalism, of sanitizing US politics, they increasingly see those US elites, US political correctness elites are engaging in something trivial and meaningless, forgetting the bigger pictures. And now we need someone to stand up, right? To destroy the whole political correctness nonsense, right?
What about civilizational? Yes. I think we're pretty clear now on what political veganism is. Yes. What about civilizational veganism? Because it seems to overlap a bit here.
Overlap a bit, but also different. I think when we look at contemporary Chinese political thought, we need to trace it a little back to late 19th centuries when China first encountered the West in late Qing Dynasty. At the time, Chinese intellectuals, liberal or non-liberal, were shocked by the superior scientific and technological political powers of the West, and they eagerly they want to learn everything, learn the trick just to make China strong, right? They gobble up everything the West had to offer at the time. And unfortunately, that was a time when scientific racism and colonialist thinking was on the rise in the West. And so if you look at Chinese intellectuals writing at the time, for example, Liang Qichao, he has been saying things like the white is the best, the black is the worst, and the yellow color, although the white people think the yellow color is inferior, but in fact, we can be as strong as the white people because our brain structure or stuff like that. So he has been saying explicit racist thing. And in the next century, because of all the turmoils, laws and interruption by politics, Chinese the development of social sciences and humanities in China have been largely stalled, right? So there have not been quite a reckoning with this scientific racist past and with this underlying colonialist thinking, imperialist thinking in Chinese folk social political psychology. So when fast forward to the present, we see from many of the writings, both by Chinese liberal intellectuals and non-liberal nationalist intellectuals, they constantly they have been internalizing this idea, this Western-centric idea of world order, which is premised on a kind of implicit racial hierarchy. So they are very receptive to the rhetoric that the Western European countries should not welcome immigrants, Muslim immigrants, because that would destroy the Western civilization, because Europe is committing a demographic suicide, and so on and forth. So when Trump says that make America great again, that really hits home for them. Here I might add that there's a little bit nuances, a little bit difference between liberal civilizational baconists on the one hand and non-liberals who also internalize this civilizational discourse. So for liberals, civilizationalists, they imagine the world on the basis of this civilizational hierarchy, Western-centric civilizational hierarchy, but they fantasize a time when China could rise to the top of the hierarchy along with the West. Well, China would join them to be one of the great civilizations, but that process would be hindered by by those more inferior civilizations or cultures, right? Blacks, the Muslims, they are danger. They are danger both to the Chinese civilization and to Western civilization. So we should join hand in hand to keep them in check. And for non-liberal nationalist intellectuals in China, they fantasize a moment, a future moment where China could replace the West at the top of the hierarchy. But that doesn't mean that they want the West to be brought down by barbarians, so to speak, quote unquote. Because there's a Chinese saying, 英雄惜英雄, right? So, China and the West would have a fight in the future. But, for the West to be dragged down by some inferiors or by some barbarian, that's too regrettable.
I think there are probably some people who are imagining that you can't leap directly from, you know, the social Darwinism that was imported in the age of Yan Fu or whatever, all the way in the 19th century. But that all you need to do, I mean, you look at the May 4th literature, which is full of a lot of just sort of self-flagellation about, you know, the failures of Confucian civilization, and look at not only the Cultural Revolution, where it's kind of obvious, but look at He Shang in 1989. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same stuff. It's the same themes. It's really interesting. River Elegy, if you haven't seen, important piece. Yeah. Let's move to this topic of political correctness. Ian, you put political correctness front and center in the piece that you wrote for The Times. I think both of you talk about it. And, you know, how, actually, Liao, you wrote a really great piece. I want to talk a little bit about how, you know, the assumption that political correctness is a bad thing, or that it's gone too far, just frames discussions even among many real liberal Chinese intellectuals. But Ian, let's focus on you for this. Why is American political correctness such a fixation for Chinese intellectuals?
Well, I think many people see this as a way to force people to have certain viewpoints, that you have to do things a certain way. And I think that obviously grates because people are being told this constantly in China, and so I think that for many Chinese thinkers, this is sort of the fundamental problem, that they want to break free of exactly those kind of straitjackets and the correct way of thinking and doing things. And, you know, just like in American academia now, you've often have to have a tag at the end of your email telling people how to refer to you and stuff like that. And if you don't have that, you're sort of under pressure almost to do it now. And I think that sort of thing grates, among Chinese intellectuals. So that's one. I guess, in other words, it's a typical thing where you take your own experiences and you apply it elsewhere. You think that this is a similar thing. Well, it's not really the same thing at all, but I think people see it like that.
I think before we get into Yao's piece, let's talk a little bit about this idea of Baizor, which is perhaps the easiest way to translate it is the golden doodle owning liberal in Chapel Hill. Anyway, what does Baizor mean? How is it used? And what is it about the anti-Baizor crowd that for some reason congregated mainly on the Quora clone site Zhihu? Yao, do you want to give some background on this? And maybe Kaiser, you can fill in because you've also given this some thought.
Yeah, sure. So Baizor, literally white lefties, right? White lefties, the first use, I think, by Zhihu, people on Zhihu, to describe the kind of social justice activism in the West, those who care about the plight of refugees, because I think the term was first popularized in 2015 when Europe was undergoing the refugee crisis. So those people were saying that, if you Baizor really want to welcome the refugees, open your own home, open them to your house, but just don't spread the refugees across Europe to other people's house, and so on and forth. So the term Baizor, of course, it has the zuo part, lefty. So in Chinese context, it's derogatory, and meaning that you care about equality, without any further consideration of feasibilities and so on and so forth. And the bi part, I think also has that connotation, but more beyond that. So it has a connotation of being in Chinese slangs, words like 白莲花 or 傻白甜. 白 means like you are naive, you're pure but naive, right? So, and also 白 as a racial, term, has this connotation that those 白族, those white lefties, however naive and innocent they might be, however unrealistic that their proposals are, they are white people. Like, the political agency of black and brown and Asian activists are eliminated by using this term. As if every proposal of social justice must come from white people. However naive they are the people who have ideas. They are the people who have agency. They can act. And they are coming to save black and brown people and other people, but they save them in the wrong way. They make the world worse, right? So right. I think that's the whole connotation of 白族.
So I've heard an alternative suggestion as for what the 白 in 白族 is short for. That's for 白痴. So I've heard that it actually comes from, it's kind of a translation of the conservative epithet libtard, that it's sort of, you know, mentally challenged lefties. Is there any truth to that?
No, I think that was later added. Like when after the term has been popularized and circulated on the internet, it was added, the interpreting as added. But a few years back, before it was became popular and when it was first introduced to the discourse, you could see that it apparently referred to 白人 and also 白莲花 to some extent, which was a term, if you read Liu Cixin's 三体, three bodies, right? Three bodies. And three bodies help popularize an image of a woman, Chen Xin, which was designated by the earth people, by earthlings as the savior, but was so naive and innocent and knows nothing and in the end inadvertently destroyed the earth in the process. And the real hero was some male guy. And so after the Santi was published, readers of Santi quickly invented the term 白莲花 to describe Chen Xin, which is obviously misogynistic, but also you can see how this attitude against social activism is tied to misogyny in Chinese discourse.
And 白族 no longer just applies to white liberals in the West. It actually also now is used to call out so-called social justice warriors in China, right? They're called, you know, with no irony, 白族 as well.
Anyway, yes, yes.
That's a good piece of background for this.
But, you know, I just wanted to add something. I thought also when I heard those criticisms, it reminded me also of when I was living in Europe and just after the refugee crisis and went to the United States and talked to people who were some Trump voters, and they were also saying, you know, what a disaster this is going to be for Europe, letting in these refugees. And I feel, and of course, it really wasn't actually for Europe a disaster, but it reminded me that that there's a certain amount of almost jealousy that you're actually feeling threatened by people who are trying to do something and that you're actually doing something and we are not or not able to do it, and that therefore this leads to some kind of resentment. I don't know. It seemed to me there was some sort of parallel there.
Sure.
Should we talk, Yao, about the piece you wrote for Pengbai, Sixiang Shichang? And it was translated and published by David Ownby's Reading the China Dream, which is a website, a fantastic website, which is in fact the subject of the piece Ian wrote that we published with great delight on SubChina. And we'll put a link into the show notes. Sorry, that was a rather long detour to ask you about the conversation in Shanghai involving four Chinese public intellectuals discussing the Black Lives Matter movement. Can you give us a sense of how prevalent this is, even among people who do not support Trump?
Yes, so you can see, as you can see from the article, the lecture I was responding to, the among four professors in China who are anti-Trump, who are you might call right. true liberals in China, they have been taking in, they have been using the term political correctness, and they have been falling prey to this way of framing public discourse, right? And I think that's one of the defining features nowadays of the Chinese internet, because people keep talking about those imported terms and keep framing public discourse in that way. Political correctness, cancel culture, and so on and forth. Despite the vast differences between the Chinese political context and the US political context, right? So there have been, I think political correctness has been on top of everyone's mind on the Chinese internet. Whenever some heated issue comes up, one party will quickly descend into accusing the other party of using political correctness to advance its own cause and suppress the other side's opinion and so on and so forth.
It's always like that. Ian, I'm curious, what explains this eagerness by so many Chinese intellectuals to see in so-called political correctness a kind of threat to a return to Maoist dogma? I mean, it comes up a lot, even if you read Fofbed, but what I want to zero in on here is that obviously, there's a lot of the same thing. The conservative right uses it. They are always, immediately start tearing down statues. Oh, that's the Red Guards. But what strikes me as really interesting is the way they seem to crib so many of their arguments, the Chinese intellectuals, directly from the United States. They use the same sort of, abusing of evolutionary psychology to justify their claims about, genetic differences in intellect or that are tied to race or to gender. They crib the same arguments about Islamophobia. I've seen, for example, perennially in the kerfuffle over the so-called African problem in Guangzhou, they will use the same talking points that you see on alt-right American websites. I mean, it doesn't seem, in other words, to come just from the experience of the Cultural Revolution. Their touchstone seems to be Ben Shapiro or Jordan Peterson or whatever. This seems to be what they're reading. It's really strange.
Yeah, I mean, it often strikes me that when it's always so interesting in telling what one culture takes from another, because we were in the West taking, I've been taking strange things from China for decades and decades, if not centuries. And when Chinese look at our intellectual discourse, they sometimes, as you point out, take the what seem to be the oddest or least convincing arguments not made by the sort of top-notch intellectuals in the West. I mean, these are not the bright, they're often very thrilling reads if you're willing to put aside, your sense of judgment, but they're not really top-rate thinkers, but they come across well in China. I think, because a lot of that reminds me sort of Ai Weiwei and when he was sort of active and this sort of putting down people and this snarky social media thing. I mean, of course, we've had that all around the world now, but it's really quite prevalent in China. And this is like one of the few areas of intellectual debate that you can kind of have, because there aren't sort of peer-reviewed journals or there aren't magazines like, say, The Atlantic or whatever, The New Yorker, where reasonable opinion makers will sort of debate issues. It's all in the social media sphere. Right. And so, people like that, if you can stick your finger at somebody, poke them in the eye and so on, then you've sort of scored your point. That's sort of the only way to win arguments. So I think they come across well because it's almost like a cocktail party chatter level of intellectual debate.
Right.
We've already discussed a number of layers to these questions with us talking about how Chinese people are talking about U.S. politics, us watching them watching us. But let's add another layer just for shits and giggles. So Ian and Yao, you must have gotten quite a response in China or from Chinese liberal intellectuals here in the United States about your recent work on this topic. So what did they say about what you said about what they say about American politics?
Well, I can tell you one thing. So I interviewed for my piece for The Times, Li Rei's daughter, Li Nanyang, who I've written about before. And she's a real pro Trumper or Trumpet or whatever. And her material got cut out of the piece. And so I mentioned to her, yeah, sorry about this. And then before I knew it, she sent out an email blast to all of her followers about how she had a discussion with me and that I'm sort of a well-meaning guy, but I don't really get what's going on. And that, you know, and this went out to, I don't know, like 500 people on her email distribution list. But I think maybe that, I'm probably in their eyes a perfect example of a Bidesawa, you know, like some shagwa sort of type of guy, which is probably true. So anyways, but that was one reaction I got. Yeah.
That's funny. From so just Li Rei, who he was somebody who was a Long March survivor, who was quite high in political life in China, and then sort of became I guess you'd call him a dissident, yeah. I mean, after he was one of the authors of one of those open letters in the early 2000s.
He championed sort of counter histories in China, right. And was one of the patron saints of China Through the Ages, or however you want to translate that magazine's name. And so, yeah, and his daughter has sort of kept the flame alive. She's just living temporarily in the United States, but she's a Chinese citizen and still, I think, would represent some of the Chinese sort of left liberal thinkers. I mean, yeah, however you want to describe
it. What about you, Yao?
Well, what about you, Yao? Yeah, because we can't blame your piece, your work on your whiteness.
You're not a Shagua either.
I've been receiving emails and social media messages of two kinds, as you can imagine. One kind is, oh, thank you so much for explaining this. This has been puzzling me for years. And finally, I see a explanation and which is quite convincing, right? And so on and so forth. And the other kind is, hey, you are a piece of shit. You are Wu Mao. You are sent by the CCP to defame the great Trump. And when Trump get reelected, you will be deported. You get ready for it. Pack your stuff and so on and forth. And to one of the email, I reply that let's see if he gets reelected or what.
Well, he would have if not for all the election fraud.
Yes.
He's still in the White House, Kaiser. Yeah, you persist in your optimism that everything's going to be fine. Those of us from other countries have the go bag packed.
Leo, at the end of your paper, you suggested that the outcome of the election was going to be a great way to see whether the political beaconism or the civilizational beaconism was ultimately the stronger. What do you conclude now, having seen what's happened?
Yeah, exactly. As you can see now, pro-Trump liberal intellectuals have been falling into two camps. They are even fighting with each other now. One camp says that let's accept the loss. Let's acknowledge Biden's win. Let's uphold. Let's together support American democracy. And the other camp, which I think is much larger, still refuse to accept, and they have been circulating those conspiracy theory. I've been having quite a fun as I currently in several of those pro-Trump WeChat groups, just observing what they are saying. Like they have been coming up with theory every day. Today they have been saying that. Why didn't the Supreme Court support Trump? Because the Supreme Court. Of course, think about it. Three of the nine justices are appointed by Trump. How can I not support Trump? So the real reason is that they have been working closely with Trump to gather more evidence. And only when the evidence is sufficient to convince the whole country that Biden is a fraud, will the Supreme Court act. So now let's don't 打草惊蛇, let's don't hit the grass to scare the snake and so on and forth. And Sun Liping, one of the professors I mentioned earlier, the sociology professor, yesterday published a WeChat article, a very short article, saying that a lot of friends have been asking me how the U.S. have come to this point. My answer is that let's keep faith in Trump. Not he didn't say that explicitly. He says that I will give you a short answer, but I won't be too explicit. My answer is that civilization is always, should always take priority over institutions. Right, that's exactly what I said in my paper about the about civilizational bigness. Who will prioritize the perceived survival of Western civilization over the preservation of American political institutions? So I think the difference between political and civilization bigness is becoming clearer and clearer. If you look at how those two different camps within pro-Trump liberals react to the electoral loss.
One more for you, Liao, before we go back to Ian. And you posit that younger Chinese intellectuals will be, on balance, less persuaded by Trumpism than their old compatriots. They're going to be less ready to make those cultural revolution connections, even though I should say, you know, if anything, it's the Trumpian populists who are more closely, you know, like the Cultural Revolution. I mean, they resemble it a whole lot more than BLM does. But anyway, these younger people are more tech savvy. They're presumably able to tell, you know, the nonsense from the real news. And you also, though, but on the other side of the ledger, is these are also people who are more receptive to kind of to nationalism, to civilizational vindictiveness, to use this lovely phrase of yours. I love. Did you coin that phrase, civilizational vindictiveness?
Yes, I did.
Oh, that's brilliant. I'm going to be using that from now on. Anyway, what do you think? I mean, where do you come down? Do you think that, you know, when you look at the balance, on the one hand, they're more tech savvy and further away from the Cultural Revolution. On the other hand, they're more stridently nationalistic. What's their verdict going to be?
So I'll be cautiously pessimistic, I would say. I think my take is that within the liberal camp, younger liberals will be less pro-Trump, less receptive to pro-Trump rhetorics because they're tech-savvy and so on and so forth. But the liberal camp is shrinking, right? So not only because of the disastrous performance of the liberal camp this time, but also because the larger environment, indoctrination from early on in primary schools, from primary schools on, and censorship and so on and so forth. And you can see the rise of this wolf warrior generation. And and they are also tech savvy, right? So they know how to appropriate many of the liberal talk points and turn it into backing nationalist policies and nationalist ideologies. So I think in the future, we will see less the curious performances from the liberal camp. But the larger power balance between the liberal and non-liberal camps is firmly against liberalism in China.
You're absolutely right about that jujitsu. They're able to take those Trumpist type of talking points and turn them. I mean, Cui Zhiyuan did that, as you point out in I can't remember which of the papers, about how, you know, he took these Bannonite ideas about ethno-nationalism and sort of, you know,
Jiangshigong.
Exactly.
Ian. I think we're kind of running out of time, but a big question for the future: what will the dissident intellectuals do now, given that their espousal of some of that Trumpian nonsense is not likely to endure them to Biden's team? Assuming, of course, Biden actually gets to be president, which my American friends still seem quite confident about. So do you think these intellectuals will change their tune with the change of the political environment in the United States?
I don't think they'll change their tune too much. Of course, Trump will probably fade away, or at least won't be a force in politics, and it won't become quite such an issue in a year from now. I'm sure he'll still be around. But, you know, I think it raises questions for the new administration about who their interlocutors are, who they're going to go out to save when they go to try to save China or whatever. I mean, obviously, there's still a lot of people who are victims of human rights violations in China who need, you know, U.S. help or whatever, the Uyghurs and so on. But I think that it's hard because these were sort of the people who would get invited, let's say, to the Yale Law Center, and that you know, Jeff Prescott used to head, and who will now be on the NSC, and these are sort of the logical people who you would always invite and have to your talks, and I don't know who they will go to now. I mean, it's not that they'll cut these people out, but I just think that natural affinity isn't going to be there anymore.
It's going to be Tung Biao, Tung Biao, and Tung Biao. He's like the only one left. He's a true believer.
The only sane, normal. Sort of,
No, that's classics. Not true. There's still others. There's still others. I mean, like Li Miao, for example. So thank you both so much for taking the time to chat with us. We look forward to having you both back on the show. What a fun conversation that's been. Let's move on now to recommendations. But first, really quickly, I want to remind everyone that if you like the work we're doing with Seneca and with the other podcasts in the Seneca Network, like the China and Africa podcast, the best thing you can do to help us out is to subscribe to SUP China Access. For just $88 a year, you get a wealth of news on China delivered to your inbox every day. Jeremy and his team do a fantastic job on this newsletter, so please check it out. Recommendations. Jeremy, you start us off as usual.
Okay, I've got three quick ones. Firstly, the Google app on your mobile phone is now really good at identifying plants and even birds.
Really?
And all kinds of things. And it's just introduced a kind of Shazam-like feature where you can hum a tune and it will identify the tune for you. But the plant identification function is really, really good.
Wow.
I hate promoting the company that's taking over our brains, but Google app is a pretty good app if you like nature and want to identify things. Second thing I want to recommend is the BBC World. I've kind of had it with NPR. I've realized that American mainstream media is slowly rotting my brain because it makes you so sort of obsessed with what's going on in this country, which is kind of a topic we mentioned at the top of the show. And the BBC World remains a great antidote. And, you know, if there's one thing going for Britain after Brexit, I'd say it's the BBC World. I don't know. There are a few other things. They have some nice stuff they stole in the British Museum, I guess. And finally, on the topic of today's show, but, you know, looking at similar questions from a different era, the book In the Red by my friend Jeremy Barmé.
All right. Okay. Leo, what do you have for us?
I would like to recommend two books, one on China and the other on the U.S. The first book, Discourses of Race and Rice in China by Cheng Yinghong, or Yinghong Cheng, a historian at Delaware University, which traces contemporary racism and all the racist discourses in China, which correspond perfectly to my idea of civilizational baconism. So if you want to know more about this, check this book out, which came out late last year. And the other book is Anthony Scalia and American Constitutionalism by Ed Purcell, which came out this year. So if you're wondering, how come the U.S. conservatism has come to this? How come the U.S. legal judicial system have come to this? Check this book out and see how Anthony Scalia and other so-called originalists have used legal rhetorics to advance their partisan goals, partisan objects with all these legal jargons. And the book breaks down quite well with all those cases and relevant discussions for you.
Excellent. That's exactly a question I've been asking myself.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. That's great. So Antonin Scalia and...
American Constitutionalism.
Okay, and American Constitutionalism. Great. I will make a note of that one. Ian, what do you have for us?
Well, there's a magazine article that I was just reading that I really liked, I thought might be worth looking at, called Confessions of a Clinton World Exile in the current issue of Vanity Fair. It's about this guy, Doug Band, who was worked as one of Clinton's right-hand men during the administration and then set up the whole Clinton Foundation. And it just lays out the whole corruption in that world. And I think sort of points or helps explain the rise of Trump as a reaction to that. The whole cronyism with Chelsea in the foundation and so on and so forth. It's a pretty interesting insight into the workings of American political elite. Another book that I really can strongly recommend, and I be doing a review of it that will appear months from now, I'm sure, in the New York Review of Books, because I have such a long queue. But it's called Forbidden Memory, Tibet During the Cultural Revolution. And it's by Tsering Woser. And I guess many listeners may know Woser is a Tibetan writer who lives in Beijing. And she found these photos that her father had taken during the Cultural Revolution. And they were published in 2007 in Taiwan, but they've been published now in English translation and strongly reworked and expanded. She went back to parts of Tibet again with really long cut lines that are like essays on the Cultural Revolution. And it's a really rare, rare photos, because there just were not a lot of photos taken, period, in Tibet up until, you know, say the 1980s or something. So these photos are just stunning. Her father had been an army officer, so they were really quite unusual things. And then finally, just to reiterate what Jeremy said, but a little more even focus, would be I listen to the BBC a lot also, and I would strongly recommend the BBC Global News podcast, which is a 25-minute podcast twice a day. And the great thing is, of course, it'll have U.S. news, but it only has at most, say, 5 minutes of U.S. news, and the other 20 minutes are from parts of the world you just don't hear about on NPR. And there's just a different level of professionalism. You don't have this kind of whiny, sing-songy American reporters that you get on NPR. Oh, hi, it's Betsy here. Oh, how friendly.
We're talking the same language.
I just can't stand it anymore.
Oh, God, it's so horrible. It's like, shut the fuck up and tell us what's going on in the Gambia. You know, we've had enough.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and so the Global News podcast, I mean, I know the BBC is probably under a lot of pressure, but they're just great. And it's a good way to get a news digest, I think. So those are my three things.
Just to fuck with you guys, I'm going to do my recommendation in my best NPR, in my best NPR announcer voice. I want to recommend following Chen Chen Zhang on Twitter, because she's someone who writes about these same topics and is super smart. She teaches now at Queen's University Belfast, and I first encountered her work after she wrote about the idea of Baizhuo and really helped shape my own thinking on how so many Chinese people seem to have embraced Trump and what he stands for. I actually asked her to join us in this conversation because, as an NPR announcer, I believe in diversity and gender balance. I actually did ask her to join us, but she was too busy. But we will have her on one of these days. I think she's just brilliant. I know that she probably read your paper pretty early on, right? Right?
Yes. I sent her the draft. And I would like to second your recommendation.
She's brilliant, yeah.
Yeah, and also, yeah. Just to add on that, a little bit of self-promotion, but also promoting Chen Chen. She and I and two other friends, Guo Ting and Li Hanlun, we are co-hosting a podcast in Mandarin.
It's great, I've been listening.
Called Shicha In Between Us.
Yeah.
Check it out.
It's really great. I was going to say, that's a good podcast. I love it. You guys are fantastic. I mean, I don't. There's not a lot of Chinese language podcasts that I listen to, but that's one of them. So I really love it.
Thank you.
All right, Ian. What a pleasure as always. Can't wait to hang out again. And congrats on your recent fatherhood.
Oh, thank you. Yeah,
congrats.
About an 8-month old baby who has been quiet for the past hour. So I've lucked out.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
Yeah, Liao, what a delight. I'm really glad that we finally got a chance to talk in person. I admire your work tremendously, and I can't wait to see what's next from you. Jeremy, as always.
Yeah, thank you. That was fun.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week. Take care.